Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Fiona Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. The sun is shining, so, you know, that's good. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I am watching a wood pigeon. They're always quite fat, so I was going to say a fat wood pigeon, but I think that's almost like a kind of a tautology.
They're nicely plump, aren't they, wood pigeons?
They're very rounded. Yeah, so he's waddling along the garden path. So I can't complain.
Am I boring you, Thea? Do you need something else to look at while we're talking?
Well, I can't see you, so I've got to look at something.
That's true.
Anyway, Lucy, we've had a couple of letters this week from listeners. Do you want to tell us about those?
Yes. Well, remember a few weeks ago, we were celebrating our wonderful listeners because they were sending in their versions of our theme tune. And so we played some of those. And this week we've had some communications, a lovely, very thoughtful letter about from someone who was responding to lots of things we've talked about, actually, including Samuel Beckett, and particularly the idea about re-readings. And also a letter from someone who talked about, after talking about Dungeons and Dragons last week, I think Camille mentioned a bed that she made from the beards of defeated kings, and we all said...
Oh, with cushions, yes, stuffed with bits of beard.
And we all thought that would be terribly uncomfortable. But apparently that has a literary history as well, because in Arthurian stories, there were coats made from the beards of defeated kings. And their owners attempted to sort of claim Arthur's beards as one of them, which I was thinking about. That's exactly what I would do. If you had a big cape with lots of beards of the people that you defeated, you'd go, yeah, that's Arthur there. Yeah, I beat him.
I mean, that would be very uncomfortable. I think it's beginning to sound a bit more like mortification of the flesh stuff.
I mean, maybe, but it's not easy being a leader.
It's not indeed.
I imagine.
Right, well, coming up on this week's show, Stevie Smith, a poet of fatal miscommunication, her famous line, not waving, but drowning, died 50 years ago this month. A new adaptation of her work sees the actor Juliet Stevenson embody this awkward and mesmerising poet who seems determined to confound. Noreen Masood will tell us more. And we have a new poem by Paul Muldoon, read by the poet himself to mark 400 years since the birth of Andrew Marvell. But first, exactly 200 years ago in the Peloponnese, a ferocious uprising began, with Greek peasants taking arms against their Ottoman rulers. And this culminated eventually in Greek independence. The Greek War of Independence was perhaps the earliest triumph of nationalism, writes Mark Mazower in this week's TLS. A nationalism of the sort defined by Lord Acton as the idea that nations would not be governed by foreigners. In that sense, Mazower says, the Greek case was a forerunner in the political struggles that transformed the map of Europe and created the world we inhabit today. Now, there is pomp, ceremony, and industry of commemorative mugs and fridge magnets, but this was not always so. Before pride came score settling, indifference, and ideological piggyback riding. And as is always the way, the real story is far more complicated than any of those narrative frames allow. So today, we're going to look at the history of the history, and hear the story of Greek independence told in new, more material ways. Mark Mazower joins us on the line now to guide us. Mark, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So I've sketched the very, very basics there, but I wonder if you might briefly put us a little more in the frame of 1821 and its immediate aftermath. Because, I mean, I said the odds were against the Greeks, and that's a pretty massive understatement, really. And that aspect is important, that mismatch, because it became such a powerful part of the myth.
Yes, it's a very complicated story, but the essence of it, I think, is quite simple. In 1821, 200 years ago, Europe was essentially a continent of empires, and the southeast of Europe was a part of the Ottoman Empire that had ruled it for many centuries and was one of Europe's great states. And when the Greek Revolution began as a kind of peasant insurgency, you would have had to say that the odds were entirely against the Greeks because there was not many of them. They were poorly armed, although they had some ships, and they were facing the resources of not the most powerful state in Europe, but a very significant, powerful state with a well-established bureaucracy. And in fact, nobody at the time believed that the Greeks could pull this off by themselves. And arguably, even the organizers of the revolution didn't, because they were counting on the Russian army to come in and help them, which didn't happen. And yet somehow, over the course of that decade, they hung on and they hung on, and they eventually won their independence at the end of the 1820s.
And what were the first attempts then to chronicle the events? You mentioned a French historian in particular.
I think one of the striking features of the 1820s across Europe is that ordinary people have a very profound historical consciousness. They have a consciousness of living in history, and they have a consciousness of their capacity to make history. This was something new. I think it was a product of Napoleon and the example that he had set and the experience of living through the Napoleonic Wars. And so one of the very striking features of this is that as soon as the fighting starts, everybody's sort of saying to themselves, we're making history, we'd better chronicle it, we'd better record it. They're sort of playing out these parts before the audience of the present, but the audience of the future as well. And in particular, there is a man in the French consulate in Smyrna called Raphanel, who starts to chronicle this. And in fact, he writes the first volume of his History of the Revolution in 1822, which means he must have substantially completed it at the end of 1821. And he goes on to write another two volumes and a history of the Greeks before he is killed fighting for the Greeks outside Athens. But he's just the first. There are many people who go into print while the war is going on, writing histories of the war. So the idea that this is a subject worthy of the historian is kind of hardwired into it from the beginning.
But that, that kind of real-time chronicling, that was to a degree, that was sort of flooded out, wasn't it, by the deluge of another kind of writing that followed. You describe a sort of, as the printing press cranked up, it was almost more about score settling and stabbing each other in the back and accusations.
Well, the printing press was new. It wasn't new to the Greeks, but it was new to Greece. Under the Ottomans, there had been no printing presses. And so when Greece becomes independent and the Kingdom of Greece is established and gets going from 1833 onwards, printing presses are established, there are newspapers, and the Greeks fall in love with the printed word. Many of the protagonists in the War of Independence or the Revolution, we can talk about what the proper term for it is, had more or less spent as much time fighting each other as they had fighting the Ottomans. And once the war was over, they continued to settle their scores with each other, this time in print. And so the early decades of the historiography of the Greek War of Independence are really a kind of score settling, and in which somebody defends the honor of his island or his region against the others. And so now we come back to this, and we have this extraordinary material that's written by people who are in the middle of it, who knew many things that would otherwise be forgotten, but who were incredibly partisan.
Can I just ask about the effect of the revolution and the War of Independence on the rest of Europe? Because, I mean, it's a possibility, isn't there, that it was sort of influenced by the French Revolution and then, as you said, the Napoleonic Wars. But it was very, am I right in thinking it was sort of taken up? I mean, that's where Byron went, isn't he, and nobly died in the Greek cause.
Byron's life, and especially Byron's death, were absolutely instrumental in Europeanizing the conflict. The idea of further revolutions in Europe was anathema to the powers who were settling the peace after the defeat of Napoleon in 1815. And so when revolutionary activity emerged across Southern Europe in 1820, in Spain, in Naples, in Piedmont, and then in Greece, and of course there was other revolutionary activity going on in South America in the Spanish colonies, the powers reacted vehemently against this and tried to stamp it out. And so the climate of diplomacy in 1820 and 21 was fervently anti-revolutionary, and nationalism was part of the revolutionary sentiment that they feared. The achievement of the Greeks was to smash this approach, to smash the Holy Alliance, the coalition of great powers that was defending this approach, and create a new coalition around the idea of a kind of guided intervention that would allow the Greek nation to emerge. And of course, the Italians and the Poles and Hungarians and many other nationally minded groups saw Greece and what the Greeks had done as a kind of example for them. They came and fought in Greece, and then later they took refuge in Greece when their own struggles fizzled out or failed. So Greece became a kind of sanctuary for political exiles. But it was really the precursor, the model of all the great national uprisings and revolutions that punctuated the 19th century. And in a sense, the diplomacy that created Greece was the model for the diplomacy after the First World War that turned Europe into a continent of nation states. So in terms of its international repercussions, I think it was an event of decisive international importance.
And so, I mean, you would think then that in the immediate aftermath of it, the new Greek state would see it as very important to frame the way the story, the history was told. But in reality, in the aftermath, the Greek state doesn't seem to have played much of a role at all in how the history was told. It was more left to individuals. You mentioned a young researcher collector called Giannis Vlakoyiannis.
Well, the thing to remember is that the Greeks win their independence, but it's a very kind of odd winning of independence. It's sort of half given to them by the European powers. And the deal is you'll get your independence, but it'll come in the shape of a Bavarian king. And the Bavarian king and his entourage were not great supporters of the idea of revolution. And so they were very suspicious about many aspects of the struggle that had in fact brought Otto his throne. And so they had a very ambivalent attitude to the revolution. And also they knew that as far as Europe was concerned, the real cultural capital lay not in talking up the events of 1821, but in going on and on about ancient Greece and how you could now come to Athens and see the Parthenon, and the Parthenon was cleared of its military remains. The Acropolis had always been a military garrison. It had not had a great symbolic power. And they clear off the garrison and they demolish the Ottoman village up there, and they demolish the mosque up there, and they turn it into a kind of shrine to Europe's vision of where it comes from. So the cultural capital for the Greek state lies in catering to Europe's love affair with ancient Greece. And meanwhile, the history work is being done elsewhere by amateurs or by foreigners. And the Greek ministries, if they're not neglecting their archives, are throwing them away. As you say, it's left to a few passionate amateurs to go around the scrap heaps and collect them. And it's not until 1915 that the Greeks actually get round to establishing a state archive.
It's a fascinating insight as well into the idea that having the Parthenon and the Acropolis as the seat of Western civilization, they only actually started really sort of selling that, flogging that, as you say, really quite recently.
Oh, there's a struggle for the Acropolis, which is a military struggle between the Ottomans and the Greeks. And the Acropolis is a military fortification, and it has all the amenities that are necessary to keep a small garrison up there permanently. And its function is to be the garrison for the town of Athens. Yes, you get the odd traveller coming through, and if you're Lord Elgin, you hire some labourers to lever off choice bits of marble and yes, flog them to the British Museum. We can get into that if we
don't have time
to.
I don't think
that's a whole other podcast.
There's a wonderful engraving in the book of a man called Dodwell of this actually happening, of the workmen standing up there on the pediment levering off the sculptures and lowering them to the ground. But that's what it had been. But the minute the Bavarians come in and they decide that Athens will be the capital, they embark upon plans in which they are going to essentially demolish everything that is post-classical on the Acropolis to free up the vision of the visitor, so that the 19th or 20th century European tourist has a completely unmediated vision of the ancient past that is now somehow stripped of all the excrescences of the intervening years, because there were medieval remains, there was an important medieval tower, there were many small, humble homes up there, there was of course a mosque, and many of these things had been built on and around the great temples. And all of this is stripped and demolished, and the earth is thrown over the side of the Acropolis down the slopes. And so if you look at the first drawings of the Acropolis from the 1830s, you see this whole fortification system that by 1880 or 1900 has vanished. When Virginia Woolf goes, or when Sigmund Freud goes, they see nothing but the ancient site, which is what we see today.
It's fascinating, the force with which history is written and rewritten. I suppose the mood, the way of framing things changed again as we enter as we reach the fascist period. I called it ideological piggyback riding earlier, but I think it's less playful than that made it sound. What was the drive here was a very clear one to kind of talk up the heroism and to draw a very clear line between the two movements, so to speak.
Yeah, well, Greece was a very polarized country in the 20th century. For much of the 20th century, there was bitter conflict between left and right in Greece. As I'm sure you know, there was an explosive civil war after the Nazi occupation. The resistance during the Nazi occupation had explicitly looked back to the heroism of the Greeks fighting the Turks in 1821 as a kind of model to promote its own nationalist credentials. They were building on the first socialist historians of 1821, who said that what really mattered in 1821 was class struggle, was economic interest, and so on. And they had a point. This had been completely neglected. And then, contrary to that, there was, if you like, an anti-communist version of 1821, which was all about great mustachioed heroes who were devoutly orthodox and kind of poster boys for some kind of macho fascist ideal. And I'm really caricaturing a school which, in fact, had some very good historians in it. But when you get to the period in which Greece falls under the power of the colonel's dictatorship between 1967 and 1974, what you end up with is a kind of fascist kitsch in which these army colonels embrace the memory of 1821. And they sort of ram it down everybody's throats. It's all over school, it's all over the marches, it's all over anniversaries. There was a great irony in this, which was that the Greeks had fought in 1821 with no regular army. In fact, the thing that they all loathed, all the capitans and the warriors loathed as they were fighting one another, was the idea that there should be a regular army. And here was this military dictatorship in 1967 of regular army officers embracing the memory of these guys who would have shot them if they'd had the chance.
And you mentioned to kind of give a sense of that commemoration machine, how in 1971, the 150th anniversary of the uprising, more than 300 books were published on the subject. And within that context, you also mentioned a historian called Despoina Temeli Katifori, who sounds like a formidable figure. And she was researching and writing during the junta, but she wasn't researching and writing along the lines that they would have liked.
Yes. So the Hunza wrapped themselves in the flag and they published an immense amount. But of course, some of it is actually quite good and some of it is quite valuable. And there are professional historians working on this. The real problem after 1974 is that when they fall, they really put most people off, including most historians, off the whole subject of 1821 and the revolution. And one of the few people who hadn't been put off was this remarkable historian called Despoina Temeli Katifori, who had been working quietly away under the junta on the problem of piracy in the Greek merchant fleet. And she and others around her had published under the junta, and then they continued to publish in the intervening years. And then something I think very important happened in the 1990s, which was this: when the junta fell, a whole young generation of Greek social scientists came back to Greece who had fled into exile. They were mostly leftists. They'd gone to Paris, or they'd gone to Munich, or they'd gone to Berlin, or they'd gone to London. And the university system in Greece over the last 30, 40 decades expanded enormously. And so the study of history and the writing of history in Greece in the last 30 years has flourished. 20 years ago, 15 years ago, people started getting interested in 1821 again. They had had enough time to get over the junta. And the result is now that we have the 200th anniversary of the uprising, I think we're in a very different place from where we were in 1971, where if you were doing good work, you were really in a minority, and there was this awful publicity machine that the junta was sort of megaphoning at the top of its voice. Now there's really an immense amount of very serious work that's being done, much of it in Greek, most of it in Greek, but actually quite a lot of it available in English and French as well. And suddenly whole new areas of this subject that we thought was dead and buried are revealing themselves to be completely understudied. The whole question of what the Ottomans thought of 1821 is really scarcely studied and is now being studied for the first time.
You give such a tremendous impression in this piece, and just hearing you talk now, of such a kind of pulsating historical field in Greece, full of vigour and exciting new directions and collaborations.
Yes, it really is. I mean, it's deeply impressive. You know, when one's in England, one doesn't necessarily know very much about what is going on in the field of scholarship in Portugal or Liechtenstein or Sweden or Greece. The fact of the matter is, in Greece at the moment, there's a very remarkable situation in which there's huge general interest on the part of the public in the country's own history, and very high quality research being done in the universities by, I would say, a young generation of scholars, two or three generations of scholars, perhaps. I'll give you one example about many. This extraordinary research project that was carried out from the universities of Corfu and Crete into shipping in the Mediterranean in the 18th century, in which a team of about 20 international researchers scoured every conceivable archive across the Mediterranean to put together a picture of shipping and trade in the 18th century. And of course, shipping is one of the few areas where ordinary people leave their mark on paper in the 18th century. And so it becomes even more than just a study of the world of shipping. It becomes a story of mobility of people across the ocean. Remarkable work that has produced two large volumes of collected essays. It's an exciting time for historians in Greece, I think.
Well, you've made that very, very clear indeed. Thank you very much, Mark Mazowas, for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, a new poem by Paul Muldoon to mark 400 years since the birth of Andrew Marvell, and Stevie Smith, a new adaptation stages the unsettling power of this poet of the too present and too much. And if you have enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, this is a gentle reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcast, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, please do drop us a line at letters@the-tls.co.uk. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we get to Stevie Smith, we're marking 400 years since the birth of Andrew Marvell. In this week's TLS, we have three new poems, all responses to Marvell, all singing with rhyming couplets to make the master proud, by Angela Layton, Will Harris and Paul Muldoon, who's with us now to read his own contribution. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I wonder, do you remember your first encounter with Marvell?
I do indeed. I read Andrew Marvell, or Marvell, depending on where you come from, as a teenager. And I actually read him first in the Metaphysical Poets, the great anthology of the Metaphysicals, edited by Helen Gardner. And I read him there with Donne, of course, and the various other great poets of that era, George Herbert, inter alia. But Marvell was always a hero. You know, I one of my favorite poems then, and it has stayed with me ever since, is To His Coy Mistress, one of the great poems in the English language, and probably a few others besides. So I love his wit and his absolutely boundless technical expertise. I mean, he really is quite remarkable in that regard. They were all remarkable, of course, but Marvell is particularly so.
I'm going to pick you up on a tiny point there that you just mentioned in passing. You said Marvell or Marvell, depending on where you come from. And Lucy and I were talking about this earlier because she said she wasn't sure, and I said, "Oh, I think I've only ever heard Marvell." What's the breakdown then? Because I mean, is it a bit like scone and scone and scone? Because I would say scone, so I don't know now if I need to realign my Marvell.
Well, some people say Marvell, and I think there are one or two puns in his own work that suggest that Marvell was an appropriate pronunciation of it. But honestly, we're talking about one of the great poets of the English language.
Well, I see why he would prefer Marvell. I said just now in my little introduction that these poems are responses to him. Yours is quite explicitly so, isn't it? I mean, his The Mower to the Glowworms is met now with your The Glowworm to the Mower. Can you say what drew you to this one in particular? Is it the endurance of those foolish fires, or what did you want to capture or return to here?
Well, The Glowworm is, funnily enough, is a feature of life that I hadn't really known intimately when I lived in Ireland. But since I moved to the US about 35 years ago, the lightning bug, as the glowworm is known in this part of the world, is really a very common feature and a beautiful, beautiful aspect of life. I did, a few years ago, write a poem in which I compared the lightning bug to the little green light on a computer. You know, I'm always interested in finding new similes and metaphors in the world. I think that's one of the things that poets do, and it's certainly one of the things that Marvell and co were interested in. I mean, they excel in the astonishing, often long drawn out simile. So I decided I thought, what would Marvell do under these circumstances? And not that I come anywhere close to what he would have been capable of, but I did enjoy the idea of just switching things around and seeing what would happen if the roles were reversed, as it were.
Right, well, Paul, let's have your poem then, please.
The Glowworm to the Mower. Since you're unlikely to astound yourself by having more to save than hay, small wonder you've not found why wave upon successive wave would summon far inland sea sounds from a dull scythe or sickle. When Juliana and you downed tools to lunch on cheese and pickles atop the triangular mound with its outcrop of hairy vetch, for which your meadow is renowned, it must have felt like the home stretch to a safe harbour. Black whorehound in the shuch, the sun a sea gong. All afternoon you would expound on how a mower must be strong, while Juliana, tightly wound as ever, slowly went off script, the vetch garland with which she's crowned, having by dusk completely slipped the ties by which lovers are bound, also substantially weakened. We mourn all those poor souls who've drowned because our own inconstant beacons have led to their running aground. Bear in mind, it's by and from you, and not the other way around, we glowworms steer and take our cue.
Paul Muldoon, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. You may have picked up in the background some atmospheric seagulls on my roof. Speaking of the sea for you. That was a lovely reading. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Mind yourselves.
Paul Muldoon's poem and those by Angela Layton and Will Harris are in this week's issue of the TLS in print, online and in the app edition. Now, though, from one poet of Yorkshire's East Riding to another, Stevie Smith, Lucy Dallas, over to you.
Why would you want to listen to poetry that made you feel awkward, unsettled, whose rhythm was nearly but not quite right, illustrated with odd drawings without an obvious connection, chanted to a half-remembered tune? Because that poetry is by Stevie Smith, and because it has power and wit and great depth of feeling behind, or perhaps because of, that very awkwardness. Noreen Massoud, whose book on Stevie Smith is coming out later this year, has written about a performance of Smith's poetry, and we're delighted that she's here to talk about it with us. Noreen, many thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us about the event you reviewed, the format and the performance element of it, please?
Sure. So the event was Dead Poets Live Black March, which is named after one of Stevie Smith's poems, Black March. And it sort of starred James Lieber, who wrote the script, and Juliet Stevenson. And Stevenson was playing Smith and reading out some of Smith's poems, alternating with kind of remarks that are culled from Smith's novels, her interviews and so on. And interspersed with those, James Lieber interjects and explains little bits about Stevie Smith's life and passes quite a lot of critical commentary on her poetry. So it's sort of a dialogue, but a strange one, in which James is addressing the audience, but partly Stevenson, and Stevenson isn't necessarily addressing anyone. So already there were kind of weird missed encounters going on in a very Smithish way, I think, in this performance.
And Stevenson, she's playing Stevie Smith in this adaptation. She's the latest in a series of people to take on the role. I think most famously Glenda Jackson did.
Yes, it's really lovely watching all the different Smiths. So Jackson in the 1978 film is quite a little bit austere, but mostly kind of melancholy, a little bit wistful. Zoe Wanamaker was Smith, I think, in 2015. When Hugh Whitemore's play Stevie was brought back. She was very mischievous. And what really struck me about this Smith by Stevenson was how sharp she was, looking you dead in the eye, reciting snappily with sort of indignant emphasis on every syllable. I felt quite I shriveled up in my chair guiltily as I watched. It was extraordinary. And again, you know, a completely valid way of playing Smith, who I think was absolutely capable of that kind of affect.
Well, we have a clip of Juliet Stevenson as Stevie Smith here, in fact, taken from Dead Poets Live, a reading of To the Tune of the Coventry Carol.
The nearly right, and yet not quite in love, is wholly evil. And every heart that loves in part is mortgaged to the devil. I loved, or thought I loved in sort. Was this to love akin? To take the best and leave the rest and let the devil in? Oh, lovers true, and others too, whose best is only better, take my advice, shun compromise, forget him and forget her.
So Noreen, you say that when people stage adaptations of Stevie Smith, involving her life, there is often an inevitable extra man there, as James Lever seems to be playing in this one, either to interview her or comment on her or mediate her in some way. Why do you think this is?
Yeah, it's a strange tradition. So Smith herself incorporates it, I think. She has a radio play called A Turn Outside from 1959, where she's talking to a mysterious interlocutor who is revealed, and again, male, very kind of paternal and a little bit condescending, who's revealed at the end to be Death, and he takes her outside. So they have the extra man there. And then in Hugh Whitemore's play in 1977, there is the characters of Stevie, her aunt, and the man, who sort of comments from the side. And here, you know, Dead Poets Live is participating in that tradition. And I think there are sympathetic and unsympathetic readings of that, aren't there? And my instinctive response is to feel that this is a way of sort of a kind of necessary translator of Smith, or a feeling that a translator might be necessary to kind of mediate Smith and apologize for her as one is encountering her. Yeah, and I find myself suspicious of that impulse.
Because she famously, as you say, lived in a house of female habitation, and she did have relationships with men, didn't she? They didn't seem to be the most important ones of her life, and maybe that's difficult for, I don't know, for some reason that seems difficult for people to deal with.
I think so. I think it's definitely a sense of kind of balancing it out, or, you know, I think that might well be the justification anyway, or feelings about making things more accessible. And I think we should think really hard about why we need a man to make things accessible. But of course I could just be being cruel here. But I think one of the joys of many of Smith's poems is that one finds oneself in a space where men are irrelevant. She has one poem where the main character's mother wants her to get off with the right sort of chap. But instead, the protagonist puts on a hat and is taken away to a desert island where there are no men. In another poem, a little girl, bored by listening to visitors talking, runs through the French windows and into the wilds and meets a beautiful naked lady and stays there with her forever. Over and over again, we have Smith sort of creating spaces without men, or, you know, and those could be either places of solitude or places with women. And I think, yeah, I would be interested to see whether future productions sort of take advantage of that more, sort of make more of that, that femaleness.
And you talk as well about the awkwardness in the performance and say that this seems right, because that's often the feeling that her work provokes. I've got two rather horrible questions here relating to that, I'm afraid. So how does she, as a poet, create this feeling, and why do you think she does it?
I can only speak for what I think, and many may disagree with me. Lots of ways in which the awkwardness is created, and one of them is a kind of, you might start off in one place with the poem. You might start in perhaps a space of comedy, and then as the poem goes on, you're sort of drawn imperceptibly into a space of tragedy, and you don't quite know when that's changed, like when the transition happened. And that's quite awkward. Also, stuff with the form as well. You've got rhymes that aren't quite right, a meter that isn't quite right. You have kind of, there's another poem which says in its subtitle that it's set to boys and girls come out to play, but that only works at something like the first three lines, then it kind of wanders away from that meter. So it's almost like somebody carrying lots and lots of plates and dropping some and apologising and getting distracted and bumping into things. And it's not just a kind of staging of a kind of poetic discombobulation, but also it's very discombobulating for the reader, where every time one feels one has a sort of safe platform from which to read Smith, that's turned upside down, that's lost. So you end a Smith poem not really knowing where you've ended up. And I just think it's extraordinarily interesting for a few ways. And I suppose the main one is I think awkwardness is interesting. One of the things that Smith is always channeling, you know, in her dress, in her drawings, is the kind of early teenage girl who is just growing into her new body, who all her limbs are the wrong size, her hands are the wrong size. There's this wonderful drawing of a girl standing with her hands straight out in front of her, and it's got a caption, "What should I do with my hands? But what should I do with my hands?" And I love it because it's exactly what a sort of gawky teenager does at a party, you know, perhaps an adult party, and she doesn't feel quite at home there. So there's something about adolescence, I think, and the awkwardness of adolescence in which Smith is very interested, but which he also finds very generative, I think, for her work. Something is happening in those early teenage years, which Smith uses as kind of a wellspring for her work. Yeah.
And as you say, it's a curious mix, and there are a few poems, as you say, that start out very funny and then often end up somewhere very bleak. I was thinking about Thoughts About the Person from Porlock, I've always thought is very much like that. And there's also the shorter one, you mentioned Do Take Muriel Out. How do they treat that one in this show?
It's a very interesting one. Obviously, there was an interest in making Smith relevant to our pandemic times. And Smith was very tired all the time. She sort of thought of herself as someone who was constantly exhausted. She spent all her life in the suburbs with her aunt. Particularly towards the end of her aunt's life, she spent a lot of time sort of in the house in a way that we are having to do now, and had a kind of interest in solitude of the sort that many of us are experiencing during lockdown. So in the performance, as Stevenson reads Do Take Muriel Out, we get scenes of a sort of a woman in lockdown, sort of coming out of the shops alone, wearing a surgical face mask and doing a jigsaw on her own with a glass of wine next to her. Yeah, and I think there are legitimate links to be made with the way we're living now and the way that Smith lived, although there's a lot of pleasure in Smith's solitude. You know, I don't know necessarily that we're meant to pity Muriel,
but also the person being addressed to take Muriel out is not, as we think, some nice young man or somebody to draw her out of herself, is it?
No, quite. As the poem addresses somebody saying, "Do take Muriel out. She is looking so glum. All her friends are gone." And at the end, it's revealed, "Do take Muriel out, although your name is Death." And that's a very interesting spanner to throw into the works when we're faced with a deadly pandemic, and us going outside may actually mean death, either for ourselves or for other people. So again, we have an awkwardness here. We have, like, what exactly are the politics or the allegiances of this juxtaposition? And I think the performance sort of it is an awkward moment. The performance sort of cuts back to Juliet Stevenson's face for the last stanza. What kind of imagery could justifiably be appended to that?
Also, Noreen, you have to, as you do in your piece, can you please tell us about your encounter with the rollerblind of Stevie Smith?
The rollerblind, yes. So, so when I just started my PhD, I think it was a year in, I was 25, and I went on my first ever archive trip to the Hull History Centre, Stevie Smith being born in Hull and living there till the age of three. They've got a wonderful Smith collection, including the original manuscript of the novel On Yellow Paper, whose paper is actually yellow. And I asked to see everything in the collection. And I came into the room and saw that a long paper roll had been laid diagonally across a table, the map table. And I was directed over there. And I began to unroll it. I was very new to archive study, as I say, it was my first trip, and it seemed perfectly possible to me that might be how you stored manuscripts, just bundled up together in a big roll of paper. But something else started to come out, some sort of things thick and brown. And I was sort of staggering under the weight of this huge thing, which was 7 feet long. And when I'd finally got it unrolled, it turned out to be a roller blind, 7 feet by 6 feet, with a poem by Stevie Smith, a five-line poem written in thick black marker pen and dated 1969, 4th February 1969. And that was it. And I had no idea that there was a blind in the archive. I hadn't even properly looked, really. I just said, I'd like everything by Smith, please. And in my memory, although this is it dims at this point with sheer embarrassment, in my memory, the staff in the archive were very interested in this roller blind, and some of them had come out of a back room to watch. There were several of them lined up against the wall, and I felt very acutely the embarrassment, the awkwardness of having turned up and demanded this huge, heavy object. And I had to demonstrate that I knew what I was doing. So I sort of marched to the counter and asked for weights and a magnifying glass and inspected the blind solemnly from all angles and stood on a chair and took photographs of it from above, nodding. I think there was nodding. I think I nodded to myself knowingly and made little noise.
Oh, yes, the blind. Oh,
yes, the famous blind. It was absolutely mortifying. And I took more photos of that blind than I did the manuscript of Novel on Yellow Paper in the end. Just, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Because when one meets a librarian, whenever one does any archive work, the librarians know so much more than you do. I get annoyed at people who claim to have discovered things in the archive often, because the librarians knew they were there. They've been working with these collections for years. You haven't discovered it. You've just read, you've read the archivist's guide. So, you know, as a scholar, one is almost a sort of pretender to the glory of the archivist's knowledge, you know. And I just felt as a first year PhD student, I had to live up to them. I had to prove myself worthy of being in the presence of these god creatures. And, you know, I'm sure all I managed to do was make them laugh. I'm sure they have hundreds of people trooping through those doors regularly to panic over the blind and take photographs of it.
Well, it's very tempting to go and do that very thing right now because you've said
so.
That. I think
so. I think we should send a whole procession of people to the Hull History Centre.
I just love that this image of Stevie Smith sort of from beyond the grave forcing you and other scholars to kind of contort their bodies in awkwardness. Yeah. Just she's forcing this awkwardness upon you, almost like a Bruce Nauman kind of, you know, you read the instructions and you find yourself contorting into these strange, absolutely, uncomfortable shapes.
I think she would have loved it.
Was that wasn't the only version of the poem written on the blind, was it?
No.
Was just that this happened to be written by Stevie Smith, so you were going to get it because it was written by Stevie Smith.
That's it. I had no idea at this point that you could, about the things that one can find in archives. You know, I thought it was all manuscripts. I knew nothing.
Well, you don't expect roller blinds.
No, you definitely don't expect roller blinds. Locks of hair, sure, diaries, but roller blinds. So it would have been wonderful if that was the manuscript of the poem. What an entrance, ooh, into the world for the poem. But I think I gather that she was at a party and it was like a party trick. She wrote out this poem on a roller blind. It certainly wasn't her roller blind. So I hope the owner was all right with this transformation.
Oh, I see. But then, so what you do is you roll it back up, and then when someone comes around, you casually pull it down and say, "Oh, I had Stevie Smith here the other night," and then you've got the Stevie Smith poem on your blind. Do you think that's
exactly
the idea?
I had Stevie Smith around, and she defaced my property. Look. Such confidence to believe that your graffiti can only improve a situation. I admire it.
It probably did, though.
Oh, yes. 1969, yes, that was she'd got nice and famous in the 60s, so, you know, I expect it was a nice thing for the owner of the blind to have.
Well, that was a wonderful and suitably awkward anecdote. Your words, I wouldn't dream of saying that you were awkward. I'm only going on your account.
Oh no, very awkward, yes.
But thank you very much for talking to us about Stevie Smith today.
It was a pleasure, thank you so much.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Noreen Massoud, Paul Muldoon and Mark Mazower. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson, a weekly series of in-depth interviews with high-profile figures examining how overcoming the challenges of their early lives shaped the people they've become. This week, businessman and chair of the Cultural Recovery Fund, Sir Damon Buffini, describes his journey from a Leicester council estate to being named the most powerful black man in Britain.
A group of my peers who I thought I knew just decided that they'd make my life miserable, and they excluded me from sport societies, cocktail parties, or everything. Couldn't really find out why they were doing it. I think one of my friends said, you know, the reason why they're doing it is because they don't think you're a real gentleman.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson. Sir Damon Buffini, in his own words. Now available as a podcast. Listen on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.